You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I'm your host, Ann Lucas.
In the U.S., there are a handful of specialties that have been on the front line of responding to the genocide in Gaza. They are mostly from public health, sociologists, and social workers. Indeed, I've had the privilege of sharing multiple events where public health workers give their insights and findings on Gaza and the occupation overall. Today, I'm finally able to share some work from the sociology side of things. On September 17, 2024, Sociologists for Palestine did a teach-in on the boycott, divest, and sanction movement, broadly defined. The purpose of the teach-in was to think about the use of economic pressure in supporting the fight for Palestinian rights. It focused quite a bit on universities, but also on frameworks that could be applied to other institutions and in many situations. This teach-in had my personal BDS dream team. It included Omar Barghouti. Omar was one of the most important architects of the Palestine academic and cultural boycott of Israel. It also included Lisa Hajar. She is a sociologist of law and human rights, specifically international law. And it also included Maya Wind. She is the author of the book Towers of Power and Steel, about the role of Israeli universities in settler colonialism and apartheid. Sophia Edwards from Johns Hopkins University hosted the teach-in and will do proper introductions in a moment. But first, just some housekeeping. This is a much longer pod than usual because all of the information from the whole thing was really just so great. I didn't want to cut anything. So just remember there are chapters for the pod, so you can skip around and find different speakers and topics as you like. This teach-in was a real shot in the arm I needed to get back up and keep doing the work. It wasn't only the things that can be done. It was also a reflection on progress and possibilities for what can be done going forward. At a moment when the news from Gaza and now Lebanon and our own universities is worse than ever, I needed to hear almost everything they said. I needed it not just for strategy and tactics, but also for inspiration and reflection. And I think you will get all those things out of it too. We really do have so much to listen to. So yalla bina, let's go.
Okay, good afternoon if you're on the East Coast. And welcome to everyone who is tuned in to this teach-in today. My name is Sophia Edwards, and I am an assistant professor of sociology and a member of Sociologists for Palestine. Thank you for joining us today. As of the latest figures of the number of Palestinians whose lives have been taken in Gaza since October 7th, in this latest advance of the Israeli settler colonial project, those numbers have surpassed 40,000. And this is obviously an incomplete count. And over 95,000 have been injured, including children. Thousands more are missing beneath the rubble. The women, of course, face a triple oppression in the words of Claudia Jones, and death is rampant by state-inflicted crises of starvation, displacement, failures in public health infrastructure, and raids, shootings, and bombings, which are still ongoing. Every outburst in the advance of the Israeli settler colonial project takes the lives of tens, hundreds, and thousands of Palestinians. In 2021, over 300 Palestinians were killed and over 19,000 injured. In 2014, over 2,000 Palestinians killed, over 17,000 injured. In 2009, over 1,000 Palestinians killed and over 6,000 injured. This history of the state of Israel's settler colonial violence and land expropriation dates back to the 1940s. These are not just numbers. These are people, human beings. This sordid history of settler colonialism, the logic of elimination, imperialism, racism, gendered violence and oppression, labor superexploitation, militarism, and capitalism spans across continents, across generations, and knits together the millions of people who these forces aim to subjugate. I am speaking to you today from Baltimore, Maryland, in the United States, on the ancestral land of the Piscataway and Susquehannock nations. Not only is there a shared history of oppression and exploitation, Palestinian resistance and steadfastness is part of a shared history of struggle, of unity against subjugation and solidarity. Sociologists for Palestine is a collective of members of the American Sociology Association who are working in support of Palestinian liberation. Earlier this year, the members of the ASA approved a resolution calling for the permanent ceasefire in Gaza and academic freedom. S4P also pushed the ASA Council to vote to divest from weapons manufacturing companies and develop a process for reviewing other investments. As we continue to build on this momentum, we've organized this teach-in to learn from the wisdom of these esteemed panelists about the boycott, divest, sanctions movement and how we can support and enable solidarity with Palestinians in our role as sociologists. So thank you for coming out, and thank you to the S4P organizing committee and subcommittee who worked to put this event on today. Today we have three speakers. Our first is Omar Barghouti, a Palestinian human rights defender, co-founder of the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and recipient of the 2017 Gandhi Peace Award. He holds a BSc and MSc in electrical engineering from Columbia University and is pursuing a PhD in philosophy at the University of Amsterdam. He is the author of BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights, and his commentaries and views have appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, among many others. Our second speaker, Lisa Hajar, is professor of sociology at UC Santa Barbara. Her most recent book is The War in Court, Inside the Long Fight Against Torture. She is co-chair of the editorial committee of Middle East Report and an editor of Jadalia. She has also written for her writings for the Middle East Research and Information Project. We will post some of these resources during the event so that people can keep them. And Lisa will talk about Israeli human rights violations and war crimes. A third speaker, Maya Wint, is a President and Andrew Mellon postdoctoral fellow at the University of California, Riverside. Her research on the reproduction and international export of Israeli security expertise has been supported by the National Science Foundation, the Social Science Research Council, and the Kilam Loretz Trust. Her first book, Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom, investigates the complicity of Israeli universities in Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid. So Maya will be talking to us today about Israeli academia and academic boycotts. Each speaker will talk for about 10 to 12 minutes, and then we will open up to Q&A. Of course, this is a webinar, so please type your questions, and the organizers behind the scenes will send them to me, and I will post them to the speakers. So once again, we are really, really grateful and thankful to our three speakers for taking the time to share with us and educate us in this session today. And I will now turn it over to Omar.
Thank you so much, Sophia, and thanks, Sociologists for Palestine, for the great work you're doing. Almost 1 year into its genocide against 2.3 million Palestinians in the occupied and besieged Gaza Strip, Israel is daily committing live-streamed massacres, showing an unprecedented level of perceived invincibility, or what even the meek UN Secretary General calls total impunity. In partnership with the colonial West, led by the US, Israel is not only exterminating tens of thousands of indigenous Palestinians, but also bulldozing the very tenets of international law in the process. Both should concern humanity at large, scholars and academic institutions included. In July, the International Court of Justice ruled overwhelmingly that Israel's occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, is illegal, that Israel is practicing apartheid. In January, the court had ruled that Israel is plausibly perpetrating genocide in Gaza. Both are crucial steps forward in our struggle to dismantle Israel's 76-year-old regime of settler colonialism and apartheid, as they show beyond doubt that ending complicity with this regime is not just an ethical obligation, but also a legal one. But Palestinians have no illusions whatsoever that justice will shine on us from The Hague or from the UN head office in Geneva or New York. The utter failure of the international legal system, dominated by Euro-American colonial powers, to provide the necessary, unambiguous, legally binding foundation for stopping the world's first televised genocide, let alone delivering justice, speaks volumes. We have international law on our side, despite its mechanisms being dominated by the colonial West. We have the moral high ground as an indigenous people fighting a ruthless, depraved, genocidal settler colonial regime to achieve our inalienable rights. Ethics and the law are necessary in our or any other liberation struggle, but they're never sufficient. To dismantle the system of oppression, the oppressed invariably need power as well. People power, grassroots power, intersectional coalition power, solidarity power, media power, among others. Palestinians are not begging the world for charity. We're calling for meaningful solidarity. But before both, we are demanding an end to complicity. The most profound ethical obligation in situations of severe oppression is to do no harm and to repair harm done by you or in your name. As the struggle that ended apartheid in South Africa has shown, ending state, corporate, and institutional complicity in Israel's system of oppression, especially through the nonviolent tactics of BDS, is the most effective form of solidarity, of building people power to help dismantle structures of oppression. Launched in 2005, the nonviolent BDS movement is led by the largest coalition in Palestinian society. It's inspired by the South African anti-apartheid struggle and the US civil rights movement. And it is rooted in a century of Palestinian popular resistance. It aims at ending Israel's regime of occupation and apartheid and upholding the inalienable rights of the indigenous Palestinian people, especially the right of refugees to return and to receive reparations. Anchored in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the BDS movement categorically opposes all forms of racism, including anti-Palestinian racism, anti-Arab racism, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism. It targets complicity, not identity. A 2022 poll shows that 16% of all Jewish Americans support BDS, with the percentage rising sharply for those under 40. They understand that there is nothing Jewish about Israel's siege, ethnic cleansing, massacres, occupation, land theft, apartheid, or indeed genocide. And therefore, there's nothing anti-Jewish in supporting BDS to end these crimes and systems of injustice. The BDS movement advocates for building people power to end all forms of complicity. The Palestinian consensus is asking the solidarity movement for two things. First, to respect and advocate for the comprehensive rights of the Palestinian people, including the right of return for refugees, as mentioned, and two, end all complicity. During its ongoing genocide, Israel has committed not only domicide and sociocide, but also scholasticide, a term coined by Palestinian scholar Professor Parman Abulsi. It has damaged or totally destroyed every single Palestinian university in Gaza and hundreds of schools, killing educators and students in shocking numbers. The heads of 15 Palestinian universities have called for isolating Israeli universities, which for decades have consistently been a pillar in the design, implementation, justification, and whitewashing of Israel's system of oppression, as meticulously documented in Maya's book, Towers of Ivory and Steel. The student-led uprising must be understood in this context, an inspiring response to the Palestinian call to end complicity. It's a sign of Palestine's South Africa moment, as the solidarity movement is reaching a tipping point in the struggle for Palestinian liberation. The B and the D in BDS have never been as prominent in the mainstream as they are today, thanks to these valiant student and staff mobilizations and many years of patiently, consistently, and strategically planting seeds of true solidarity by millions around the world, including in trade unions. So what's the BDS movement calling for right now at the level of academic institutions? 2 points: cutting academic ties to Israeli universities, divesting from and excluding from procurement all companies that are implicated in Israel's human rights violations, particularly its atrocity crimes. A recently published legal expert analysis by three legal scholars at the University of Antwerp in Belgium shows that cutting ties with complicit academic institutions is not only a right, but also a duty, in order for universities in the West not to be complicit in Israeli atrocity crimes. Complicity is absolutely incompatible with any notion of neutrality claimed by some university leaders. But if our people power on any given campus does not, cannot yet allow us to compel the university to immediately cut academic ties with Israeli universities, we need to adopt an incremental yet principled approach based on what we in PACB call strategic radicalism, adhering to our ultimate goals and principles, yet setting achievable, incremental, sustainable, and meaningful wins on the road to achieve those goals. The inspiring achievement by Sociologists for Palestine in the American Sociological Association is a bright example of that. With large intersectional coalitions, for instance, we can mobilize pressure on academic associations and universities to adopt what we call a policy on ethical academic ties, or PEAT, that says, for example, this institution will not maintain or initiate academic relations with entities, universities or institutions, that knowingly and persistently perpetrate or significantly and verifiably contribute to or facilitate, through long-term structural complicity across the institution, gross human rights violations, especially war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. To end, some complain of genocide fatigue. Let's remember that Palestinians, especially in Gaza, do not have the luxury of genocide fatigue, as Israel continues to massacre, starve, forcibly displace, and exterminate our people. Palestinians have never given up hope in our decades-old resistance to Israel's ruthless regime of oppression. This is hope rooted in our people's insistence on our continued existence in our homeland. It's a resistance to the structures of colonial oppression and in the inspiring growth of the global solidarity movement and its impact. To end, as the writer Nadim Aslam says, quote, "Despair has to be earned. I personally have not done all I can to change things. I haven't yet earned the right to despair," end of quote. Keep organizing, keep hoping, keep winning. We can and shall prevail over the genocide, over apartheid, and over all their unspeakable oppression. Thank you.
Yes, so I want to also express my gratitude to sociologists for Palestine for inviting me onto this webinar and to being in company with Omar and Maya. I'm going to be focusing mainly on international law and its violations. And so as Omar just explained, you know, BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, is a principled pressure campaign. I mean, it seeks pressure to achieve things through civil society types of nonviolent pressure actions. So what are the principles? The principles, you know, that undergird BDS are, one, that international law violations by the Israeli government against Palestinians warrant some kind of action taking the form of pressure in lieu of or in absence of other options. Another principle is the failure of Israel and the international community to uphold the law vis-a-vis Palestinians. So there's what the law says should happen and what's actually happening to Palestinians. So that failure is part of the principle to correct. And another principle is the refusal of Israel to self-correct for violations or to pursue domestic accountability. I mean, there's never really been any serious accountability for the multitude of crimes that have been perpetrated against Palestinians by Israeli military and other actors. And so that lack of domestic accountability elevates the importance of international law. So one of the things I always teach my students, you know, I teach sociology of law or sociology of human rights, is that law is a lens, and particularly international law is a lens to judge the world. And we use that law to judge whether or not people are being able to enjoy the rights that they deserve, you know, the panoply of rights in international law. And international law is particularly useful in contexts where people don't have access to other kinds of law. So for example, and this applies to Palestinians among others, people who are stateless or unrepresented by the state that rules them, international law is important. For those people who don't have domestic means, like avenues to use domestic laws and legal institutions to protect themselves, and also where gross violations are violent, are rampant and unchecked. And so those, particularly the gross violations being rampant and unchecked, it raises the international responsibility, the responsibility of actors in the international community to hold the violating state accountable. So this is why international law doesn't enforce itself, but it provides us with a way to sort of judge the world and judge what is happening. And in this context, what is happening to Palestinians. So the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has always been implicated in international law and institutions. We can just say from this, you know, the 1947 UN partition plan was, you know, sort of the original point of sort of what becomes of historic Palestine. But so if we think about international law and why it's so complicated and contentious, sovereignty, state sovereignty, you know, is a right under international law. States have a right, you know, to sovereignty, and people have a right to self-determination. And so those two, you know, very important international law principles, when they are in conflict, as they are in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, you really see fights over how to interpret international law. Other, you know, international norms are equality, non-discrimination, civil and political rights, and also the rights of refugees are grounded in international law. So really, the BDS movement emerged, you know, we can say that there's been a lot of, you know, since 1948, 49, many kinds of international law violations, but the BDS movement is primarily focused on the post-67 events and developments, and particularly those in the occupied Palestinian territories of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, those territories that were occupied in the 1967 war. And one of the, you know, sort of where we think about how the utility of international law, as particularly as it applies to the BDS movement, but more broadly, is that international law doesn't enforce itself. And in fact, the Israeli government from, you know, even while the 1967 war, which was only a 6-day war, was ongoing, there were initiatives put into place to deviate from international consensus-based understandings of international law. For example, the argument that there was never an independent state of Palestine in the West Bank and Gaza when Israel occupied them. Therefore, the Fourth Geneva Convention, that is the law of war that applies to occupied territories, doesn't apply to Israel. And so from that understanding that was instituted in the summer of 1967, many Israeli policies, including settlement building, land confiscation, disregard for the rights of Palestinians, flow from that nationalistic misinterpretation of the laws of war, the Geneva Conventions. But we can say over the decades, one of the other aspects is that Israeli security, one of the sovereign rights of a state to ensure the security of its citizens and itself, have been interpreted so expansively as to criminalize and punish all variation of Palestinian national activities. And we can see this in the fact that, for example, in the late 1980s, during the first Intifada, Israel had the highest per capita incarceration rate in the world. Israel was the first state in the world to, quote unquote, legalize torture in 1987, and Israel was the first state in the world to quote unquote legalize, in other words, reinterpreting international law to legalize targeted killing. But one of the things that's, I think, particularly important and perhaps why BDS begins in 2005 was that in 2000, with the start of the second Intifada, for reasons that have to do with the failings of the Oslo peace process, Israel basically declared its right to wage war on Palestinians and territories that Israel occupies. And so there's been really a war model ever since, and that sort of deviates from international law. But I just want to say, like, as Omar was sort of citing what's going on now, we can just look at why BDS is more essential than ever is because of what is happening in Gaza. And we can think that what is happening in Gaza in some ways is unprecedented in terms of the violations of international law, but it doesn't begin, in a vacuum. But we can say since October 7th, the scope, scale, and speed of Israel's bombing campaign constitutes the most intense assault anywhere since World War II. And this is a military assault on a territory that Israel continues to occupy, notwithstanding its claim that the occupation ended in 2005 when Israel withdrew. That's not actually internationally legally accurate. Almost 85% of the 2.3 million population of Gaza, that's almost 2 million, 1,955,000 people have been displaced. Over a quarter million homes have been totally or partially destroyed in what, as Omar said, may constitute domicide. Destruction that has been, Gaza has essentially been leveled, and the destruction includes over 300 schools, over 200 hospitals and clinics, over 200 mosques, all of the churches, 199 heritage sites, almost 2,000 factories, libraries, archives, cultural centers. All of Gaza's universities have been leveled to the ground. Those are, all of those things constitute both war crimes and crimes against humanity. More journalists have been killed in any other war, regardless of length, and many of them were targeted for assassination. But one of the most critical issues, I think, is the policy of starvation, which was announced at the very beginning of the war, when a complete and total siege was implemented. But the starvation policy has led to, sort of the cause of death aside, sort of indirect cause of death, but definitely intentional. And according to UN Special Rapporteur for the Right to Food, Michael Fakhry has said that the spread of diseases and the Israel's starvation campaign is killing more people than bombs and bullets. And just to put this in context, never in post-World War II history has a population been made to go hungry so quickly and so completely as was the case for the 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza. So many children have been killed. Over the estimates, range around 16,000 children alone have been killed, and so many others killed, that a new acronym entered the lexicon, WCNSF, Wounded Child No Surviving Family. There are 11,000 pediatric amputees. This is more pediatric amputees, that means children who lost one or more limbs, than in the history of warfare occurring in Gaza. And what another issue is that there's an unprecedented level of torture and abuse. And by unprecedented, I don't mean necessarily on a global level, but even unprecedented in terms of Israel's past an ongoing, enduring record of torture and abuse of prisoners. So we can say that all of these things, the utility of law is that we can look at what's happening in the world and we can judge it against the standards of law. We can say that when the Israeli military uses non-discriminating weapons like white phosphorus or 2,000-pound bombs, that is a war crime. It, you know, deliberate attacks on civilians, that is a war crime. The forced displacement, torture, extrajudicial executions. But there's also the crime against humanity, which includes ethnic cleansing and the destruction of all resources, infrastructure, and the starvation policy. So I'm just going to conclude by saying that, and sort of following up with what Omar was talking about, you know, or mentioning the international, some of the international law developments that have occurred within the last year and why they are important for BDS. So one of them is, you know, that in December of 2023, the government of South Africa submitted a case charging Israel with violating the Genocide Convention to the International Court of Justice. And the International Court of Justice is the highest court in the world. And so, in fact, then in January, based on the arguments that were put forward, the International ICJ basically said that they did find plausible reason to believe that genocide is occurring. And the significance of genocide and the significance of the ICJ decision is that genocide is considered the crime of crimes. And the it also impels other states that are signatories to the Genocide Convention to act to punish and prevent genocide. So that is actually an important thing. The case itself will is still ongoing and will probably take years to resolve. The second development was in May when the chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Court requested arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Minister of Defense Yoav Gallant, particularly around the issue of the starvation policy. That's what those arrest warrants are more or less, the request for arrest warrants is seeking. And then the third thing was in July, the International Court of Justice delivered an advisory opinion on the legality or illegality of how Israel is exercising its power in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. And so these three developments, international law doesn't enforce itself, but these are part of the narrative. They are part of what gives us as scholars, as activists, and as principled citizens of the world, an ability to make arguments on behalf of Palestinian rights, on behalf of Palestinian life and society, to use international law in the arguments put forward. Because ultimately, BDS, its growing popularity, its impact, its even the efforts to crush it is part of a battle of narratives. And so I would say that it's very useful for us to familiarize ourselves with international law and to actually judge the world and use that knowledge as part of our support on behalf of Palestinians and their rights. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Sociologists for Palestine. I want to echo the thanks for hosting this important conversation. And it's always such a honor to speak alongside you both, Omar and Lisa. You've both profoundly shaped my thinking, and I know the thinking of many of us in this space today about the questions that we're discussing. So today I want to offer another piece of this when we come to understand and we try to understand not only how we are close to a year now and have not yet been able to reach a ceasefire, but to really understand what has facilitated scholasticide and the intentional destruction of Palestinian centers of education and Palestinian knowledge production, not only in Gaza, but also across historic Palestine. And one, when we come to understand Israeli violence and Israeli colonial violence, we are often thinking about the Israeli military, the Israeli security state, even Israeli military industries. But no less important, even though they don't receive nearly as much attention as they should, are institutions broadly understood to be liberal and for the public good, and that is Israeli universities. And so today I really want to offer some context for the role that Israeli universities play in settler colonialism, apartheid, and now in genocide in Gaza. And of course, when we come to think about Israeli universities, those of us particularly based in the Western academic community, and more specifically even in the United States system of higher education, this might come as somewhat of a surprise to us, because we are told repeatedly, relentlessly over many decades, that Israeli universities are beacons of pluralism and democracy. They are held up as exceptional, in fact, in the broader landscape of the Middle East. We can think to the whole host of exchange programs, research, joint research ventures, funding opportunities, study abroad programs, you know, all of these deep exchanges that the Israeli university system has with US-based universities. And these programs and these opportunities are, of course, not awarded to any Palestinian university, or for that matter, more broadly, to universities in the Middle East. So Israeli universities have been singled out for quite some time as exceptional in the landscape of higher education in the United States. And this consensus about Israeli universities is particularly striking, given that for over two decades now, Palestinians have called it into question. So as Omar laid out, PACB, the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, already in 2004 issued its call to boycott the Israeli university system on the basis of their complicity in what they called at the time Israel's system of oppression against Palestinians. And so what I want to share today is a little bit more about some of the research that I have done over the last several years that really tries to answer this question that was posed by Palestinian civil society about the nature of the complicity of the Israeli university system. And what I really found over the course of both extensive archival research in Israeli state and military archives, and browsing through collections in the libraries of Israeli universities, and through extensive fieldwork conducted on Israel's major eight public university campuses, is that Israeli institutions of higher education are deeply implicated in Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid, and really can only be understood as settler universities. And here I'm following indigenous scholars of education. And really what we mean by this is that Israeli universities are embedded in the infrastructure that sustains Israeli society as a settler society. And of course, settler colonial states, as we all know, are founded with the objective of eliminating and replacing native peoples to establish a settler nation on native land. And this logic of elimination and replacement is constitutive of the Zionist movement and the Israeli state. The stated mission of the Zionist movement was always to settle historic Palestine and establish a Jewish majority as the basis for a Jewish state. And in its early decades, it openly called this project the colonization of Palestine. And the incremental dispossession that accelerated with the Nakba in 1948, the mass expulsion of over two-thirds of the Palestinian population, this transformed the terminology of the Zionist movement. And thereafter, after its establishment, Israel just simply renamed this project and called it Judaization. This is the official terminology of the Israeli state, and this is the program to expand Jewish settlement and at the same time shrink Palestinian land ownership and interrupt Palestinian territorial contiguity. And universities from the absolute beginning have been central to this project, and this is before the state was even founded. So the Zionist movement, in fact, it founded three universities explicitly as state-building institutions. The first was Hebrew University in 1918 that was established and strategically built on the remote outpost of an apex of Mount Scopus overlooking the entirety of Jerusalem. And this location was explicitly selected for the Zionist movement to stake not only symbolic but also political and material claim to the entirety of Jerusalem. The Technion in Haifa and the Weizmann Institute in Rehovot, that were founded shortly thereafter in the 20s and 30s, were also established to advance the scientific and technological development of Israel as a Jewish state. So these were all state-building institutions. And then in the lead-up to the 1948 war, these institutions were directly recruited to support Zionist territorial expansion. And this was also through the Haganah militia, which was the leading militia of the Zionist movement, later became the foundations of the Israeli military, that established a science corps and opened bases on all three campuses through which faculty and students themselves directly participated in the manufacture and development of weapons to aid in the project of Palestinian expulsion, including through the deployment of biological weaponry to poison their drinking water. And then we see that in the 1960s onward, as Israel's Judaization program expands to new frontiers, new universities were built as regional outposts to anchor these land grabs in regions of particular strategic concern for the Israeli state. So in the largest city of the Galilee, the only region within 48 that still had a Palestinian citizen majority, Israel built the University of Haifa. In the center of the Nakab, the region most sparsely populated by Jewish Israelis, it's more arid in the south, Israel built Ben-Gurion University as a means to pull more Jewish Israelis from the central cities to the south and aid in the replacement of Palestinian Bedouins. Post-1967, as new frontiers further open up in occupied Palestinian territory, Hebrew University expands its Mount Scopus campus to Isawiya and to the lands of other neighboring communities in occupied East Jerusalem. And of course, most recently, the latest accredited university is Ariel, built in the illegal settlement of Ariel at the heart of the occupied West Bank. So really what we see is that for over a century, Israeli universities, the campuses themselves, were built and planned as pillars of regional demographic engineering. And so we begin with the question of infrastructure. But then, of course, to maintain the military occupation of the Gaza Strip and West Bank, including East Jerusalem, to differentially rule not only Jewish and Palestinian citizens, but also Palestinian subjects, has required for Israel a continual expansion of its capabilities. And here too, we have to look at two universities who immediately stepped in to offer research and expertise required to sustain Israeli apartheid. All public universities in Israel offer their facilities and their faculty for Israeli military training, advancing the career development of soldiers and security state personnel. For soldiers, this is a program called Atuda, which is academic reserve. These are specialized degree granting programs for soldiers run by the Israeli military, Ministry of Defense, in collaboration with weapons manufacturers and the Administration for the Development of Weapons and Technological Infrastructure. And what's important to understand is that the Atuda program was developed very explicitly to offer the Israeli military a cadre of highly educated and specialized soldiers amidst what is otherwise a draft of high school seniors. Currently at Tel Aviv University's Faculties of Social Sciences and Humanities, soldiers are enrolled in the prestigious Erez degree program to become officers in combat units to be sent to Gaza. The Department of Islamic and Middle East Studies at Hebrew University is currently training Intelligence Corps soldiers through an elite degree program called Chavatzalot, through which soldiers are offered linguistic and regional expertise. Many of these graduates then serve in Unit 8200 of the Intelligence Corps, responsible not only for the mass surveillance of Palestinian phone calls, text messages, and emails, but also have served this genocide over the last 11 months by creating mass target banks to guide Israeli killing of Palestinians in Gaza. And on other corners of campus, faculty and students are continuing to work to develop weapons. Rafael, Elbit Systems, Israel Aerospace Industries, Israel's largest weapons producers and global exporters, were not only birthed by Israeli universities, but continue to be sustained by them to this day. Campuses serve as critical laboratories, and they develop and refine technologies and weapons used against occupied Palestinians and then sold abroad as battle-proven on this basis. And then if we take seriously universities as sites of knowledge production, we must also look to diverse academic disciplines in the Israeli academy, including legal studies, ethics, criminology, archaeology, Middle East studies, just to name a few, who have for decades been producing expertise for the Israeli state and expanding their own scholarship and fields through this collaboration. Archaeology really developed as a field through the occupation of Palestinian territory, through the systemic looting of Palestinian artifacts and illegal excavations, and has served to scientifically substantiate Israeli claims to the entirety of historic Palestine, to erase Palestinian and Muslim history, as well as to erase them in the present through dispossessing entire communities and expanding Jewish settlement under the aegis of excavations and curating historic sites. Middle East studies also developed out of the collaboration and the intersection between universities and the military government and became a site for the state to hone regional and linguistic expertise to better rule and subjugate Palestinians. And legal studies and ethics, among other fields and criminology, developed have been developing interpretations of international humanitarian law to sanction not only what is now, any of us all knew, all along, but what has now officially been stated by the ICJ, an illegal occupation, but a wide array of war crimes. And Israeli legal scholars have been collaborating with military personnel for decades to offer justifications for military tactics and doctrines, including extrajudicial assassinations, torture, disproportionate use of force against civilian populations. And as you know, Lisa Hajar, who's here, and also Noor Arakat's crucial work shows us, this innovation has not only shielded Israel from accountability for decades, but have transformed the arena of international law itself. And so when we come to understand the impunity with which Israel has been operating for more than 11 months now, it really has been years in the making, and Israeli universities have played a central role in making it possible. And this includes Israeli universities' role in the targeted destruction, very intentional destruction of every single university in the Gaza Strip through aerial bombardment or controlled detonation, which has left over 88,000 Palestinian university students with no campus to attend. And it is really important to reiterate this. Not a single one of the Israeli university administrations has at any point in over almost a year called on the Israeli government to cease the bombing of Palestinian universities and the decimation of Palestinian infrastructure for higher education. And this is really not a coincidence, because Israeli universities not only sustain Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid, but themselves are actively enlisted in supporting this genocide. They have been enlisting their institutes, resources, and courses to produce Hasbara, which is Israeli state propaganda, to defend Israel from international criticism. They have been producing legal scholarship to shield Israel from accountability for its war crimes. And we saw this also in the way that universities mobilized immediately to counter the case brought by the South African team to the ICJ. They are continually training soldiers and developing weapons used against Palestinians in Gaza. They are granting special benefits, scholarships, and even university credit to reserve soldiers returning from Gaza to their classrooms. And just today, benefits for soldiers were expanded by Israeli universities. They are punishing students and faculty, primarily Palestinian, who dare to speak out, including by collaborating with the Israeli police to subject their Palestinian students to arrest and criminal investigation for organizing on campus and even for their social media posts. So really, this cannot be said enough. Israeli universities are complicit in genocide. And so for all of us, especially those of us based in the system of higher education in the United States, our own universities, our own academic associations, which support and legitimize and fund Israeli universities, are directly and materially implicated. And the call to hold Israeli institutions accountable, issued by PACB 2 decades ago, has been reiterated this year by the Palestinian Federation of Unions of University Professors and Employees, and every student union across every Palestinian university. It has never been more urgent for all of us, reproducing the U.S. university system as students, faculty, and staff, to join the movement for the academic boycott. Because as Palestinian scholars, students, and activists have been teaching us for over 2 decades now, there simply is no academic freedom until it applies to all of us.
Thank you so much to our three speakers for these important interventions. We have some questions coming in. I guess I will just jump right into it. We had also sent out a survey to sociologists asking questions prior to this event. And one of the things that came up in the survey as questions or concerns about joining the BDS movement is talking about, I'll just quote, "My Israeli colleagues, my Palestinian colleagues who are in Israeli universities would be hurt by the boycott and already have enough problems supporting colleagues in Israel who are pushing back as much as possible against the genocide and apartheid." How can we think about the BDS movement in relation to allies in Israeli universities? And I guess I will just open that up to any all of you, whoever wants to respond.
Well, I think that's, I mean, I think Omar can probably answer better than me, but I think it's a useful question. But we think about what does the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, not just the one on behalf of Palestinians, but what does it mean? It is a means of putting pressure on, you know, a state, perhaps indirectly through these kinds of actions. And we can see like the same kinds of arguments were made during the sanctions campaign against apartheid in South Africa, that it would hurt South Africans who were not necessarily directly implicated in, you know, the exercise of apartheid. But this is one of those, I think it's a very, you know, important question, but I also think that it is, you know, the means, the fact that people are vulnerable in Israeli universities is in fact part of what is being addressed by the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, is to alter that kind of reality.
If I can add, during the South African anti-apartheid movement, which many of us were active in, we boycotted everyone and everything South African. It was a blanket boycott against individuals as well as institutions. Whereas the Palestinian academic and cultural boycott of Israel, launched in 2004, has always been institutional. It does not call for boycotting individual scholars based on their identity, basically, because it boycotts institutions and it targets complicity, not identity, as I said. But I'm really concerned about such questions. Despite the best of intentions, they inadvertently rank Israeli lives as much higher than Palestinian lives at a time when all Palestinian universities have been destroyed completely, when Palestinian scholars and students are being killed by the Israeli genocidal machine, when someone highlights the theoretical, hypothetical concern about the possible loss of privilege by Israeli academics, and that's exactly what they would lose from the boycott. Privileges, not rights, not academic freedom. They would lose their privileges. They'll have less money to travel. They'll have, you know, less luxury, less money to spend on labs and so on, but not lose their rights. If those hypothetical privileges are ranked as so much higher than the basic fundamental right to life of Palestinian scholars, let alone academic freedom, that is extremely concerning. And then that reflects a colonial heritage that the West needs to exorcise.
Thank you. Another question that has come up is, what are the challenges of BDS now compared to the South African boycott movement?
The Palestine exception is one of the, you know, sort of critical issues. And I mean, I hope that Maya and Omar will also jump in. But, you know, we see that the nature of repression against even advocating on behalf of Palestinian life is not comparable to other, you know, things that people oftentimes would say, oh, but why is Israel being singled out for this kind of activism? I mean, there's many reasons one can say, but it is the inability of the international community to do anything on behalf of Palestinians and its meaningful governments that, you know, sort of prop up, you know, Israel's ability to perpetrate war crimes. But I think that the South Africa, the fact that apartheid in South Africa was directed against Black people, you know, was something that could galvanize people in this period where, you know, racism had really, you know, lost its kind of legitimacy. Because of various factors, the way that is, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is narrated, the way, you know, as the Hasbara movement operates, etc., it is, you know, as Omar was just suggesting, it's possible to, you know, sort of ignore or completely disregard Palestinian life in favor of other kinds of things. So the biggest challenges, I think, are really to, you know, and people now, activists are often doing this, you know, centering Palestinian life, centering Palestinian freedom in their kind of activism. And that, you know, the fact that even the idea of Palestinian life or free Palestine is regarded as somehow deeply contentious and possibly criminalized indicates what is this really this Palestine exception. And it's, you know, as I was sort of mentioned before, like we are in, you know, it's many kind of battles going on, but one of them is a battle over narratives. And I think that, you know, to push back on the legitimacy of struggling for, advocating for, fighting for Palestinian rights, freedom, and justice is, you know, should be legitimate, and it's very much under attack. And so that, I think, is really unprecedented in terms of activist, the landscape globally.
Yeah, if I can add to that, I think, thank you, Lisa, for bringing up the Palestine exception. I think that is so important, and that should be central to our organizing work here, particularly in the United States system of higher education. But one of the ways that I think we see this too is in the complete erasure of Palestinian knowledge production and the utter failure to integrate Palestinian writing and critique into our curricula. And this is particularly something that we should be thinking about, I think, as faculty. And as educators, as to why it is that there is a very rich body of scholarly work produced not only by Palestinian scholars based at Palestinian universities, but also those based at Israeli universities, who have for years been writing about the experiences and analyzing the experiences of Palestinian students under the repression of the Zionist university administrations, on the conditions of possibility of knowledge production, and doing critical scholarly work. As Palestinian scholars, there has, and some of this is in Arabic, some of it is in Hebrew, but a large portion of this scholarship is written in English, it's published in peer-reviewed journals, and yet we have overwhelmingly not taken and not engaged in this analysis, and that has been so crucial to help us understand the experiences of our Palestinian colleagues in both Israeli and Palestinian universities. And so I think that that is what the student movement and the encampments have done, have played a very important role in challenging and upending this longstanding erasure of Palestinian knowledge production that has really left us, particularly in the West, very ignorant. And so to see, you know, I had the privilege of visiting many encampments over the last year, and one of the things that was really remarkable to see are these libraries that students have put together with books, with Palestinian writing, Palestinian critique that have been excluded from their institutional libraries. And so they had to make their own. And in the same way that they had to push all of us on the faculty side to really integrate Palestinian writing into the syllabi. And they, in fact, are not only waiting for us, they are going ahead and producing their own political education materials to include research that we have failed to integrate. And so I think we have a lot of accounting to do, not only for the very material ways in which all of our universities and our academic associations uphold the Israeli university system, which then, of course, themselves are pillars of Israeli racial rule, but also the ways in which we have utterly failed to take seriously our Palestinian colleagues and to engage with their knowledge production and their scholarship.
Thank you. And for another question, what do we say when people ask if we shouldn't also boycott US and other states that participate in similar structures of oppression like settler colonialism, genocide, ethnic cleansing, and so on?
Well, I hate to jump in, but I think that's an excellent question as well. I mean, if we think about the principle of a government that, you know, violates international law with impunity and fails to pursue accountability, the United States is deeply guilty of this on many kind of levels, just in terms of my own work on the U.S. torture policy and targeted killing. But one of the things that distinguishes the United States, and I would say, like, you know, boycott away if that's something that can gain traction, because boycotting and divestment and sanctions are principled actions. But in the United States, at least to date, people who principled people in the United States can use still the levers of laws and courts and politics to seek, you know, to pursue some kind of accountability, not very often successfully. But that kind of prerogative is not at all available to Palestinians, neither citizens of the state nor those who are living under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. So there, that's one of the distinct differences about where the pressure can come from in the United States can also come from domestic forms of people exercising their political voices and sort of pursuing legal things. You know, how long that will last remains to be seen, but that's my assessment of the distinction.
Amal, did you want to jump in on this or? Well, so I can just add, I wholeheartedly agree with everything that Lisa said, and I want to add a few points about this this question, because we hear it often. And I want to just begin by saying all of us in this space today, of course, acknowledge and are fully aware that our universities are also settler universities built on expropriated indigenous lands, cleared through genocide, funded with the spoils of the slave trade. Our universities are certainly deeply embedded in the U.S. military industrial complex. So our universities are all very violent, deeply violent institutions. But there are a few key distinctions that I think need to be reiterated in this context. And the first is that in the Israeli case, or rather in the case of the Israeli universities, the communities most directly impacted by the colonial violence of these universities have called for a boycott, right? So that should be enough. That is the primary distinction that needs to be made. Palestinians have asked us for a boycott. They have laid out very clearly why it is that this boycott is warranted and why these institutions are deeply structurally implicated and must be held accountable. And so that is the entire answer, in my opinion. But in addition, I would say, and kind of building off what both Omar and Lisa spoke to earlier, which is that legal designations need to mean something to us. The fact that there is now overwhelming consensus by international legal scholars, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, even Israeli nonprofits and human rights organizations. Again, these are what Palestinian legal scholars and Palestinian human rights organizations have been telling us for years. But there is now broad consensus that Israel is a state of apartheid, and that legal designation means something and must mean something to us. And of course, also now that Israel is on trial for genocide. Right. So this raises the legal threshold and all of our obligations to hold these institutions accountable, especially in light of the failure of the international community and our governments to hold Israel to account. This is where it is up to all of us in the international civil society, and in particularly those of us reproducing the Israeli university system through our own university system. It is incredibly important for us to take action. It is the very minimum, the very bare minimum that we can do to stand with our Palestinian colleagues.
Thank you. Another question. From the standpoint of strategizing to get university administrations to hear us, do you think a broader ethical investment policy is a good way to go? Or what do you think about a broader ethical investment policy? And the person asking the question understands that this is what facilitated success at San Francisco State.
I can answer this. As I've mentioned in my talk, incrementalism is very important. And it's important to distinguish between incremental wins that are aimed to achieve the ultimate goal. So the goal is not changed. It's ending all complicity, whether through academic ties or financial ties to complicit entities or complicit companies. So that goal remains the same. But if we can achieve wins on the road to that, then that's great. That's different than reformism, which means changing the goals, basically. Accepting something less than justice, less than ending complicity, that we reject. So it's very important to view incremental wins as something to be sought after. An ethical investment policy is very important, even though it does not mention Palestine, because it allows all oppressed communities to use it to exclude companies involved in injustices against those communities. So it would serve all people in struggles for racial justice, for gender justice, climate justice, not just justice for the Palestinians. So it benefits all oppressed communities, really. Those opposed to ethical investment policies that say this institution shall not invest in any corporation that is systematically involved in grave human rights violations. Anyone opposed to that is just announcing to the world that they are a very unethical person, that they want to make money out of unethical practices and grave human rights violations. It cannot be justified. So it's a much easier way to form big coalitions, which is a form of people power, as I said. And with those big intersectional coalitions, we can push for more. Once an ethical investment policy passes, then we can push for Palestine-specific companies that are involved in denying Palestinian freedom to be excluded based on that general policy.
Thank you. We have also a question about students. So this person says they just left a university in Texas that is now systematically silencing student press for continuing to cover Palestine, as well as the criminalization and prosecution of student activists. How can we as faculty and staff protect students against these continuously growing repressions towards sharing news and knowledge production around Palestine? And if I could also tag something onto this person's question, out of the mobilizations that happened in the spring into the summer, the student mobilizations, the backlash by many institutions has been to basically strip them of their rights to protest on campus in exchange for not getting expelled or not being suspended or not having your student visa revoked and these kinds of things. So now that we're in this fall semester, entering this new period where students are back on campus, but have had their, collective organizing rights revoked in many cases, how can we support students? And also, what do you see as sort of the way forward now, given this shift in the institutional environment?
Maya, that sounds like one for you.
I'm sure we all have a lot to say about this this topic, but I think one thing that I do want to point out too, I think, is that yes, we are facing growing repression for our work on campuses, but I think that what is encouraging to me is that we are finally talking about the issues. When I was at Students for Justice in Palestine at Columbia University over a decade ago, and I know Amal has an even much longer view of the transformation at Columbia and elsewhere than I have, but what we struggled to even speak about apartheid. One of the reasons that we are seeing all of these universities lining up to pass very draconian regulations that seek to fully conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and to criminalize anti-Zionism as a political project and in our political education efforts is precisely because finally we are talking about Zionism and students are talking about settler colonialism and things that, again, we are now catching up to what Palestinians have been telling us for decades. But now in the West, we are finally addressing the root causes, and that is causing utter panic. And so I think that, yes, while we are seeing more repression, we are also finally circling in on the issue itself that we have been distracted from discussing or prevented from discussing for a very long time on campuses. So that is a very welcome and important shift that both student and faculty organizers in this country and elsewhere have been building up to this moment for a very long time. So we have reached a breaking point. I think many of us are thinking that we are reaching this at our South Africa moment. We are reaching a turning point in the U.S. Academy where the Palestine exception simply will not hold any longer. So that is one thing to say. But another more broadly, I think, is that the repression that we're seeing, the state and university administration repression that we are seeing now, precisely highlights what is at stake here. It's not just Palestinian liberation. This is a broader and more global struggle for a decolonial world order. That is what is at stake here. It is not simply ending the genocide in Gaza. It is not simply enacting an academic boycott. This is a much broader global project that we are a part of, and a broader movement that we are a part of. And it is precisely because the stakes are so high that we are seeing the egregious and relentless repression of our movement. But I think we just have to, we are winning and we will win. And we just have to continue to mobilize with our students, with our faculty, with our staff, build new alliances, build new coalitions on our campuses, and simply resist these efforts by our university administrations and by the government.
I would add one of the things about, sort of what's so significant about this incredible, broadly in the United States, across, campuses in this country, but in, across the world, the kind of mobilization over the last 10, 11 months on behalf of Palestinians is something that, and then the kind of reprisals against it, which is the question that Zofia had posed, is that, you know, people, especially one can say younger generations, of which, you know, why students are so out there on this, you know, kind of issue, is because people can see with their eyes what is going on, and they can, you know, act on behalf of the principles that they know are right, etc. And the kind of reprisals that are coming in begs the question of, like, why are university administrators putting in new policies now around these kind of forms of activism, etc.? Where is the pressure coming from? And so even the exposure of the kind of pressure, donors or politicians in Washington, the kind of calling to account the university presidents, actually fortifies the kind of, you know, clarity of, like, are we not allowed or mobilized on behalf of people who are suffering in a very particular and egregious and in these days unprecedented kind of a way? And I think that one of the real crises that this kind of reprisal moves, you know, limiting speech, conflating Zionism, anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, et cetera, is it begs a very central question in the United States, which is First Amendment rights. Now, you know, the law doesn't enforce itself, but the First Amendment is, you know, the first. It's the first of all the amendments to the Constitution, and it is supposed to be protected. And many of these repressive policies clearly violate First Amendment principles, but they are the repressive policies are driven by politics. And so we can see that, you know, there's going to be, you know, court fights, et cetera. But it is important to, you know, sort of hang on to and defend the principle of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, et cetera. And it's just, I think it's notable to say that for this very reason, the American Association of University Professors just several months ago issued a new policy reversing its policy since 2006, saying that academic boycotts are, you know, illegitimate, now saying that in fact, academic boycotts may be legitimate because of the fact that they implicate academic freedom issues and freedom of speech. And so I think, you know, this is a fight, but people who are on this side would basically say that we have, you know, a First Amendment right to express ourselves and mobilize, et cetera. And people who seek to infringe upon that are in violation of constitutional principles in the United States.
Another question that came in to the chat: how can we as students or junior scholars call out the complicity of senior scholars?
Well, as a senior scholar, I would say that's a very good question. And I think that, you know, I mean, this is something we've heard about for decades, you know, where people, you know, students, you know, and this goes back a long, long time, students either can't study issues related to Palestine or are made to think that their career will be compromised. And that is partially because of the fact that, you know, perhaps senior scholars are functioning as gatekeepers on these kinds of issues. I just think, you know, calling out individual senior scholars, like, this is like where movement activity, like, you know, rather than sort of personalizing it, just pressing on the principles of, you know, clear, critical, empirically solid analysis is a very powerful weapon for, you know, redressing the kind of censorious or, you know, sort of fact-free positions that people might take that are opposed to boycott, divestment, sanctions, and the rights of Palestinians.
Another question. On a city-based level, do you have any thoughts on what BDS tactics might be best? We have an ongoing campaign trying to get local businesses to sign onto our anti-apartheid pledge, and we've been trying to get our city council to sign a divestment and ceasefire resolution, to no avail so far. We've met often with the argument that this isn't a local issue. Any thoughts on how to push back against this?
Yes, city councils in many countries across the world, including in the US, Europe, Brazil, South Africa, and elsewhere, have taken positions ranging from announcing themselves apartheid-free zones or apartheid-free communities, as happened in Belgium, for example, to divesting from military companies supplying Israel with weapons. All sorts of motions have been passed, including in California, for example. So it's important to see how those organizers in those cities achieve those results, predominantly through establishing very large coalitions, progressive coalitions in those city councils. In some city councils, they went through the intermediate step of passing ethical investment policies and then using those to divest from companies that are involved in harming Palestinians. The argument that this is not a local issue, why should XYZ City Council in Arizona care about what's happening to Palestinians, they get it completely wrong. The point is, you're harming us. You're helping to destroy our lives and livelihoods through your investment in Israel bonds, in Caterpillar, in Intel and Microsoft and Google and Amazon and so on and so forth, and the military contractors. Those companies are actually helping Israel commit atrocity crimes against Palestinians. So by investing in them, you are helping them to maintain that. So by calling for divestment, again, we're not asking for charity, and we're not asking the city council to drop all the very important issues it handles, cost of living issues and unemployment and all the mess that you have in the US that I don't need to explain to anyone. We're saying, stop harming us. There's no excuse to continue harming us. So stop your complicit relations with those companies, because they are harming us. So you have a legal and ethical responsibility to act, to do no harm.
Okay, so this question is, I hope I can read this out in a way that makes sense. So this person is asking about how to interpret the BDS and PACB guidelines. So they had a situation where in a philosophical body, they invited a scholar from a university in Israel, but this scholar, it was pointed out that the affiliation to complicit universities in the PACB guidelines could be interpreted in different ways. So this person is asking, how should they handle ways of interpreting the BDS and PACB guidelines, and how they can read beyond the guidelines in certain scenarios in the spirit of BDS, but even if it's not in complete or exact accordance with the written guidelines. So I guess the question is, are there ways of honoring the BDS PACB movement by reading the guidelines without unwittingly misrepresenting the movement?
Yes, thanks for this. The guidelines are not, biblical. They are mainly ethical principles evolved over time through discussions and debates and dialogue throughout Palestinian communities throughout the world and with partners throughout the world. The guidelines say that we target institutions, not individuals. Affiliation to a complicit Israeli university, and all of them are complicit, is not the same as representation. So a dean, a head of a department, a president of a university is representing their university. A professor who happens to be a sociologist at X university in Israel cannot be held accountable simply because they're affiliated to that university. That is very clear in the guidelines. Now, where some nuance comes in is, what if an Israeli professor from an Israeli university is advocating for genocide, like many of them are, or has defended war crimes against Palestinians? The absolute majority of Israeli academics have, at one point or another, advocated, justified, tried to whitewash war crimes and crimes against humanity, against Palestinians, including the crime against humanity of apartheid. The absolute majority, it's not a tiny majority. So how to deal with that? Like you would deal with any bigot, any racist, defending war crimes anywhere in the world. If you have a conference at a university in the US and you're inviting a scholar from France or from Egypt or from Sri Lanka, whatever the case may be, and that professor has written things to the effect let's say Muslims or Arabs or Blacks or women are half-brains. How would you deal with that? And on top of that, he or she advocated for getting rid of those disposable communities. I mean, really genocidal intent. How do you deal with that? Clearly, there will be pressure to cancel the invitation to this professor because they are a bigot. The same rule, the same principles should apply to Israelis. They should not be treated above or below anyone else. That's what we call a common sense boycott, when you target an individual because that individual is not simply an individual, but an advocate of horrible crimes, someone who's inciting to racial violence, racial hatred, and so on.
Thank you, Omar. Another question is, even if we recognize that university and state repressions violate First Amendment rights, fighting in court requires significant financial resources. How should we think of legal versus other strategies to push back?
Well, I mean, on that particular thing, many of these sort of individual fights when specific individuals or organizations are being censored or repressed, you know, it feels like as what it is, you know, sort of multiple battles all over the place. But, you know, on that score, there's Palestine Legal, which has been, you know, has seen its workload, you know, increased by 500%, you know, in the last 10 months in defending people's rights to protest, speak, et cetera. So Palestine Legal is a very important resource. The ACLU has also been engaged in these kinds of things. And there are other institutions in the United States that will champion people whose rights are being repressed. You know, it feels now like there's just, you know, a geography of multiple fights going on. But in some sense, these fights are going to produce outcomes, you know, decisions, et cetera, that are going to have ramifications. So fights that are going on now will hopefully be won, but people who are advocating for the right to organize and mobilize and speak on behalf of Palestinians. But, you know, that is, you know, where we can say that when a number of cases have proceeded through court and we get some clear outcomes, that's going to have an impact on the future effort to censor people. If universities or institutions have lost, that is going to be a warning call for other places not to do the same kind of thing. So maybe not the most satisfying answer, but that's how I see the landscape right now.
Yeah, I think in addition to the legal arena, which, you know, Lisa is better positioned to speak to, I certainly think, you know, whether it's in the ICJ or it's in, you know, the lowest courts, you know, or even at the level of our university administrations, you know, we should not cede the ground of the legal arena. It's an important battleground for us as a movement. Having said that, I think we also have to have a diversity of tactics and approaches and not spend all of our time on the legal front, because a lot of these policies are really just about silencing and about making us afraid to do the advocacy and the teaching and the work that we want to do for Palestine on our campuses. And so one of the things I think we need to insist on is to continue to be creative and to recognize too that a lot of these policies, many of the most draconian policies of our universities are not enforceable. For example, NYU's recent policy about, you know, forbidding or the exclusion of Zionists from organizing spaces and other political events. Let us continue to do the work that we know we need to do and let them try to enforce it, right? So it's also about not getting entrapped in the world and in the terms that our university administrations are laying out for us. A lot of it is illegal, a lot of it is unenforceable, and we just have to continue to do the work as we already have and as we continue and as we know how to do, and to continue to be creative too. And, you know, university administrations have put up fences, you know, to prevent further encampments. All right, there's many other tactics as well, right? And so, you know, let's keep them guessing. Let's be creative in forms of mobilization that we do. But also, I think for specifically those of us here on this call who are faculty members or staff, I think we have an important role to play in parallel and in collaboration with the student mobilization on our campuses in terms of also bringing in Palestinian organizing and Palestinian political education through the front door of our institutions. There are a number of new Centers for Palestine Studies being formed across the country. There are other programs that are being formed as well. But we also need to we need to start institutionalizing, to do the work of institutionalizing Palestinian advocacy and political education from our vantage point, from our particular role as faculty and staff. And so we can also there are many ways that we can do this, and a lot of power has been left on the table, and a lot of very creative avenues that we have not yet explored. So I urge us not to also get solely bogged down in the regulations, legal or otherwise, by the administration or the government.
Thanks, Maya and Lisa. Another question is, are there ways that universities, whether that be in India or the United States or other parts of the world, are there ways that they could be asked to support and give degrees online or offline to students of Gaza who are currently being forced to go to Egypt for their higher education or to pursue higher education studies?
This is a tough issue that needs to be discussed with Palestinian academics. And there are a few programs, one run by Bir Zeit, another run by presidents of Gaza universities that have been demolished, with the help of Professor Karman Abulsi and others. So there are some initiatives out there. What's important is to talk to Palestinians and ask them, how can we help most? Not to assume that this is what Palestinians want, because you don't want to do something that undermines our basic right to reestablish our universities in Gaza. And that is the key. So in the meantime, yes, those students and those scholars as well need to work. Academics need to work, and many, many, many students need to have an education. So giving something that's transient, that's temporary, is important, absolutely. But keep in mind that it should not be at the expense of ending the occupation, ending the genocide first and foremost, and reestablishing the universities in Gaza to be independent. We don't want our students to rely on anyone else. The second point is that the question has a premise that is not exactly accurate, that Palestinian students in Gaza have to go to Egypt to pursue their education. They're not allowed to go to Egypt. They wish, they dream of reaching Egypt, because many Palestinian students are accepted at universities in the Arab world or in the West or across the world, in South Africa and so on, yet they can't reach their universities because they're denied by the Israeli occupation forces that are completely blocking all exits, except very, very rare exceptions. I mean, Israel is denying medicine, food, and water to come in. Forget letting students get out. So it's extremely dire. It's not like they have to go to Egypt. Yeah, they can handle that. They're not allowed to go anywhere.
I guess we'll do one last question, and then we can wrap up. Can you give us some examples of other BDS wins?
That would take an hour at least, but it's very important to check the website. So there's a post on the impact of BDS during the genocide, which shows how the BDS movement has affected major sovereign funds, like the Norwegian sovereign fund, the largest sovereign fund in the world, has divested entirely from Israel bonds, almost $500 million. That is mainly the work of trade unions in Norway that support BDS. Many city councils, as was mentioned earlier, have ended complicity with Israeli institutions or with Israel writ large as an apartheid state. Many corporations were forced to abandon the Israeli market, which is in steady decline anyway, but also because of pressure from the grassroots, from civil society, from unions. Many trade unions, dock workers' unions, have prevented ships from reaching Israel, carrying weapons to Israel. There's so many examples in the cultural sphere. Tens of thousands of artists have stood up for Palestinian rights, many of them announcing support for the cultural boycott of Israel, not to mention academic. We shared in the chat some examples of universities that have taken actions to cut links of complicity to Israeli universities or to companies that are involved in Israel's crimes. And the list goes on. There's so much happening around the world. And especially in the US, I strongly advise people to read this to get a bigger picture, because many in the US consider the US the center of the universe, actually the whole universe. So it's important to remember there's a world out there.
Thank you. In our last minute, I guess we can go around, and if you have any final message for our audience, we would love to hear your final words.
It feels good to be on the right side of history.
I hope that people on this call can remember that we are part of a broader world building project, and it can be done at multiple registers, whether that's at the level of an academic association, such as the American Sociological Association, whether that's through organizing with unions and students and other allies on our campuses and off our campuses, remembering that our university campuses are also porous and they should be embedded in the politics wherever we are, or whether it's organizing with national networks such as Faculty for Palestine Now that have over 100 chapters across the nation. And of course, there's many more in other continents as well. So I hope that everyone here who has not already, find the best avenue for you to be involved, find the register with which you feel most comfortable organizing, and join the movement if you haven't already.
My last sentence is that let's be very cognizant of their continuous attempt. There means oppressive forces, be it Israel or be it administrations on campuses in the West. They always try to colonize our minds with despair, convincing us that it's impossible to win. But we've been told that over and over, and it's only impossible until we, our agency, makes it possible. So I really think that we should never let them colonize our minds, no matter what they do.
To Maya, Lisa, and Omar, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and sharing your expertise and experience with us. We are so grateful. Thank you.
We are out of time. But thank you so much to the Sociologists for Palestine for all the great work you're doing. Thank you for reminding us that there's a lot for us we can do and keeping us going. As always, it takes a village to make a show like This Week in Palestine. Special thanks to Stan Robinson and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Steve Lowe and Mohammed El Roud. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week.